This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I'm going to start off today with the vaccine mandates that threaten to gut public agencies and hospitals. But before I do that, I have to tell you something. Conspiracy Theory Thursday today just really stands out from the last several weeks. It is full of crazy stuff. The vaccine mandate, and I'll get to that in just a moment. And the fact that both Kate Brown and Jay Inslee and other so-called state and city leaders have run into a brick wall of opposition. Number two, one of the biggest Northwest cities is now blaming last year's riots and all the trouble and the violence and the destruction they did. Who are they blaming it on? They're blaming it on the cops, and we're going to talk to a representative of the cops. I disagree with the conclusion reached by the city of Portland. We'll get to that. Bill Gates of Seattle has a hard time explaining in a national TV interview why he was trying to get money from a convicted sexual abuser of underage children who's now dead. And then record shootings that continue in both Portland and Seattle and other cities around the Northwest. A teacher's aide whose protest against vax mandates included appearing at work in blackface joins me today to tell her story. And a volunteer firefighter who says those mandates are going to gut local fire and medical protection. We're going to try to get to all of that and pack it into a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. But welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, providing honestly provocative talk for Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And if you want to join that conversation, you are certainly welcome. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And our Twitter poll today, now you can find it two places. It's not yet on Getter, although we are on Getter at Lars Larson. But it's on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and also on our website at larslarson.com. The question today: should online college classes require your kids to prove that they are vaccinated? There's one Northwest state senator who says this is absolutely nuts. If somebody is taking online college classes, what in the world could the point be of insisting that they show proof of vaccination? We're going to talk about Kim Thatcher later. We haven't been able to line up the senator for today, but we'll look forward to talking to her another day. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. I have to tell you, maybe Kate Brown and Jay Inslee should occasionally pick up a Bible. You know that proverb says, "He that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind." And if you don't understand the implications of that, it's really a great life lesson. He that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind. Now, of course, when the Bible says he, they didn't know about all the woke pronouns. They meant everybody. When a person brings trouble to his own house, he's going to inherit the wind. Well, last month, both governors of Oregon and Washington laid down an ultimatum for tens of thousands of state workers. Take the COVID jab or lose your job. Deadline October 18th. But citizens of a freedom-loving country do not take ultimatums lightly, and especially they don't take ultimatums from people who call themselves public servants. Why, we serve the public until we start telling them what to do. Well, this week, Kate and Jay realized that their own actions were about to gut their own governments of essential workers from critical jobs. You see where I came to troubleth his own house and inheriting the wind? On Monday, Jay Inslee was begging the Biden White House for more than 1,000 healthcare workers to replace the doctors and nurses that he helped blow out with his mandates. Now imagine both states with crippled state agencies, hobbled hospitals, and worker unions on the warpath. So yesterday, Kate Brown blinked. She pushed the deadline of October 18th past Thanksgiving, although there is an interesting little caveat to that. Paychecks won't be coming past the 18th, I am told. Well, that seems to me to be a head fake. Kate Brown is giving up the vaccination mandate of October 18th, but she can't afford to admit it politically, so she's trying to buy some time. And as I made the argument yesterday, another 6 weeks for people who have said, "I'll give up my job before I take that jab." I don't think 6 more weeks of thinking about it is going to change anything, but it does buy time for a desperate politician like Kate Brown. And I also predicted yesterday that Jay Inslee would probably follow suit. He has not done so yet, but I stick with my prediction. Just this morning, we learned that King County has now folded, moving its mandate back to not even November 30th like Kate, but back to December the 2nd. Again, they're buying time. I think they hope this whole thing goes away. Do you realize how much more ridiculous it's going to look, especially if the decline in COVID cases continues for the next 6 weeks? And there they'll be at the tail end of October, beginning of November, heading into a month where they're telling people, take the jab or you lose your job. And what if they have falling numbers of COVID, which I think is going to be the case? In that case, the mandate looks even more ridiculous. Both Brown and Inslee have badly managed the last 18 months, and citizens in both states see it. And those citizens have had quite enough of, well, Queen Kate and King Jay. But I want to add a couple of other things, because this is very much a human problem. There hasn't been a day in the last 3 weeks when I have not received multiple emails, sometimes as many as a dozen in a single day, from people pleading their case, saying, I'm up against it. They've told me there's a vaccine mandate. They've told me there is no religious exemption. Well, listen, you know that I'm not a lawyer. I mention that all the time. But after mentioning I'm not a lawyer, there are federal laws and there are state laws that require employers to provide reasonable accommodation for a number of things, physical disability, mental disability. They require employers to make all kinds of accommodations for people who have sickness in their family. And in this case, I literally have been hearing from workers who say, my boss says we're not going to get a religious exemption. They're not going to give it. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I suggest those workers call up Boley in Oregon, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and Labor and Industries in Washington State, and say, is it legal for my employer, even if my employer is a very headstrong government agency, to tell me they're not going to grant religious exemptions? For example, Dawn writes in from Bremerton, Washington, Lars, I'm against the wall and I need help. My husband and I worked nonstop through the pandemonium known as the pandemic. We were essential. He for WashDOT, the ferry terminal employee, me for DHL, a delivery driver. We worked every day. Now we're told to either get this vaccine or lose our jobs. Let me be very clear. We are not anti-vaxxers. Dawn, neither am I. We simply believe in the right to choose. Our Governor Inslee has taken away our choice. We can't even have a weekly test done. Vax or no job, period. We need help. We've contacted attorneys. I told Don, reach out to firstliberty.org, a private nonprofit staffed with attorneys. They are going to go to bat for people. Second, Aaron writes at Lars, my wife works for Kaiser here in Oregon. She's being faced with a threat from the crooked comrade Kate, who says get vaxxed or get fired. She was granted a religious exemption, but now Kaiser is threatening to retract those. How do you retract a religious exemption? Say, we don't believe that you believe anymore? This is from Aaron. And then finally, unnamed. I'm currently an employee at the Oregon Youth Authority on a living unit that houses 13 to 17-year-old girls. These kids are not allowed to leave the unit without gloves and a mask. They're required to wear masks at all times 24/7, including when they sleep for 10 days. He says this just isn't right. Coming up in a moment, you want solutions to the housing problems in the Northwest? I rolled out one yesterday that was cheap and effective and got an email to back it up. Talking about that next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson
Show. That makes
Larson
a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish wrapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Yesterday, I gave you my opinion on the shortage of housing in the Pacific Northwest. Actually, this kind of idea could be used anywhere in America where the conditions are such, like those in Oregon and Washington. In most of Oregon and Washington, if you want to build a house or if you want to build an apartment building and provide housing for people, there is an amazing amount of need. It's one of the reasons that rents are so high. There are some other reasons as well that tie into the pandemic. But let me start with those ideas first of all. And what I suggested yesterday, because we were hearing that literally the city of Portland had taken a bunch of money, public money, and I'm sure Seattle does no differently, and they said, hey, we're going to provide affordable housing. And they literally came up with housing that costs over $1,100 a square foot to build. Now, if you're somebody who is shopping for a house right now, You might say, well, most of the houses we like are, say, $200, maybe $250 a square foot. That's a first-class house. If you're building a brand-new house, you might say, we're really going to town. We're going to spend $300 or $400 a square foot to build that house. Believe it or not, the city of Portland is creating affordable housing. It has taken them 6 years to do it. They are refurbing an old building. So they're starting with an existing building, and all they're doing is refurbing it, and they are spending over $1,100 a square foot. Now, that kind of price will buy you some of the nicest condominiums in Seattle or Portland or almost any other Northwest city. In fact, I'd venture to say there are cities like Spokane and Eugene where you couldn't even find an apartment or a condominium that expensive. And yet, here we have the city of Portland spending $1,100 a square foot. And what are they producing? Tiny little studio apartments. And they're not fancy. So I suggested, if you want to get affordable housing, here's one way to do it. The cities have these obscenely expensive system development charges, permit fees, and the rest. Just talk to anybody who's in the business of building houses or apartment units or condominiums, and they'll tell you, before we even break ground, before we even turn over a shovel full of dirt, we're usually into the city for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in fees. And I said, if you really want to make housing affordable and you have some grant money that you're going to use, I mean, in the case of this one old hotel that they're refurbing at $1,100 a square foot, they're spending $400,000 per unit to come up with a studio apartment unit. 400 grand won't buy you the best house in town, but the median cost of an average family house in Seattle, I think, is around $600,000. In Portland, it's in the $400,000, maybe $450,000 range. So they're spending as much on a studio apartment that's not even 1,000 square feet. I think it's around 500 or 600 square feet. They're spending as much on that tiny little unit just to refurb it as you would spend to get an average family house. And I said, this is nuts. Why don't you go out and offer the developers, and I will get to the naysayer, why don't you go out and offer the developers, we will knock off all the fees, all the system development charges, and anybody who starts construction on something within, say, the next 2 years will be forgiven all of those fees. Very inexpensive. I think it would actually incentivize a lot of people to build. That was the argument I made yesterday, because I hear you when you send me emails saying, Lars, you gripe about problems. How about some solutions? So I get this email today from Alex Palm, who's in the engineering business. And he said, Lars, I caught a section of the show yesterday. You were talking about the concept of incentivizing affordable housing by reducing or eliminating system development charges. I live in Roseburg, Oregon, and like every city in the Northwest, we have a housing shortage. Prior to 2019, there had not been a new apartment constructed in Roseburg in more than a decade. That sounds like a lot of the Northwest. So he says, in 2019, the City Council of Roseburg, under the leadership of its city manager, created an urban renewal district. One of the first incentives they created via the urban renewal district was the elimination of system development charges for any type of multifamily housing. That means apartment buildings. Fast forward 2 years, there are now four different apartment projects totaling 410 units that have either just opened or are under construction. Several more projects are in the design and concept phase. The two apartment complexes that just opened were both full before they even opened. I would note the city will recoup the lost SDC money via property taxes and that sort of thing, but they'll take it over a period of years. These developments have created design and construction jobs for the people of Roseburg, an additional benefit to our community. Now, will the big cities like Seattle and Portland and Tacoma and Spokane and Eugene, will they all latch onto this? I'm skeptical. Most of them are so wedded to, we have the money up front. We want all our money up front. This is the kind of nonsense they do all the time. Now let's get to today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I got another email that suggested today's grill. Nick wrote in. He said, Lars, I just read that the ACLU represented a protester named Marie Tyvol, whose image was publicly shown from when she took part in a Portland protest sued and sued the police successfully that they had no right to publish her picture on social media. Marie Tyvol shows photos of her son to the police as hundreds gather at Portland. This is what happened. She posed for the camera. Apparently, she says she suffered real and probable injuries, whatever that means, because she was shown standing on the front lines in front of police officers. And I can only assume that some of Marie's friends, family, clients, and colleagues actually support the police and did not take kindly to her stance. If you attend a protest that's largely full of anti-police anarchists, BLM, and others who touch off violent conflicts with the cops at these protests, perhaps you should assume that someone is always watching and taking video or photographs and accept the consequences of your actions. Today's best email, and then we'll get to the naysayer. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and even a signing bonus online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Dear Lars, writes Lori, what another wonderful show. Thank you for that, Lori. Fantastic news that Kate Brown is giving medical employees 6 more weeks to get their shot. She's not. She's giving it to state employees, but the mandates from the state are those that are pushing the issue on those private health care providers. And thanks for the news about the isolation and quarantine facilities being built under the cover of darkness in Washington State. I'm going to go to Debbie in Tacoma, who's a naysayer. Debbie, we are close to the break, and I will make you the promise that if you don't get your point made, we'll provide space for you elsewhere on the show. What do you and I disagree about today?
We don't really disagree, Lars, but just a point of clarification.
Sure.
It is Labor and Industries and OSHA that is mandating the healthcare employers mandate their vaccine of their employees without religious exemptions. So when you refer employees to go back to Labor and Industries, they're stuck in the no-win situation because that is who is mandating it, with huge fines onto the employer if they don't follow it.
OSHA is doing it, but if you go to Labor and Industries and say my religious rights are being violated and I'm filing a complaint, I would double dog dare them to say we will not take your complaint, because that, after all, is their, that is their job. Debbie, thanks so much. We'll talk about cops and protests next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to what I've always called Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Why don't you imagine this crazy conspiracy? And then I'm going to ruin the surprise by saying it's not crazy, it's actually happening. All of those riots that we watched over about the last 18 months or so, they've quieted down recently. But the looting, the arson, the assaults, the murders in both Portland and Seattle. And now the City Council of Portland has voted on a report. And do you know who they want to blame? If you would guess, well, they're going to blame Antifa. You know, they're going to blame Black Lives Matter. They're going to blame criminals who committed crimes during those riots. No, they're blaming the police. And I wanted to talk to the guy who represents the police as the executive director of the Portland Police Association. Daryl Turner joins me now. He's also a cop. Daryl, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, how are you?
I'm doing well, but do the cops deserve the blame for the riots that we've seen in the Northwest and around the rest of the country over the last year and a half or so?
Absolutely not. When you talk about the riots in the city of Portland, unlike any other city in the country, we saw 150 plus days of sustained rioting every night. We saw this in a police agency that is catastrophically understaffed. And the survey that was done, the first survey that was done, it was done and 170 respondents answered that survey. 43% of those respondents experienced dissatisfaction with police tactics. That's 46 people, Lars. 46 people out of 670,000 people in the city of Portland. And the second survey they did, they closed it on September 14th, but they didn't close it. They just ended it on September 14th. Over 1,000 people responded, and most of those respondents, even though you won't hear about it, were supportive of the police and supportive of their actions during those riots. What we have is a group of people who sit behind a desk and sit in cubicles and in front of a computer in the safety of their offices while police officers are out there doing that dangerous job of protecting this city during those riots, during the carnage, during the burning, during the looting. We had a homicide. We had several assaults during that, including assaults against police officers. They're sitting behind the safety of their desks and their computer screens, writing these reports, skewing the numbers so that they can obviously skew them towards their advantage and their agenda to widen the crevice between the relationship between the police and the community. And that just isn't right, and that just isn't fair on the hardworking backs of the rank-and-file officers of the Portland Police Bureau.
Well, Daryl, I want to make sure I don't put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying they gamed the system with the first survey, that if people imagine, I'm going to take a survey on guns.
Not only did they game the system, and I don't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead.
They were dishonest with this survey because they made people believe by the numbers that they had the majority of the city of Portland, majority of the people, when in fact they had a small microcosm of people that were probably their friends and pals and besties that are out there coming to these community meetings and coming to these meetings, and they skew the surveys to get the answers they want, and they still didn't get all the answers they wanted. They need to do the work. They need not to be lazy, because if they were doing the work and they were doing it correctly, they would see that most Portlanders stand behind the Portland Police Bureau, stand behind their actions during the riots. And if nothing else, our hands were tied and we weren't able to do enough. We weren't able to stop all the carnage. We weren't able to stop all the rioting and looting, destruction of property, assaults, and even one homicide that happened downtown during riots.
Daryl, I've read through the report. The report seems to suggest if only the police had done things differently. But I'm not sure how you do things differently when people are out doing this kind of thing. What other approach to that do you have other than telling people this is an unpermitted march and you need to leave, and if you don't leave, you're subject to arrest? Have they outlined for you what they'd like you to do?
Lars, we were handcuffed during those riots. We were handcuffed by temporary restraining orders on using CS gas. We were handcuffed on temporary restraining orders by judges not to be allowed to live stream the riots so that we could arrest people who were committing crimes during those riots. And not only that, what this group did not do is they did not damn the domestic terrorists, the cowards of Antifa that were out there every night rioting and looting and burning and causing problems and not being arrested and running free in this city. And that's why today you look at the downtown area, you look at our business areas, and you look at how bad it is. It's like a ghost town downtown most days and most nights. And this is the reason why. This is the reason why it is. And they have nobody else to blame but themselves.
Daryl, did this report tag the new district attorney who came into office saying, I'm a friend of Antifa, and then he immediately declined to prosecute hundreds of cases and allowed people to understand, I can go commit crimes, I won't be prosecuted, and they're going to put me right back on the street? Did any of the report take issue with Mike Schmidt?
They didn't take issue with anything else. They took issue with the police because they want to be able to heap all that on the backs of the police officers who are out there doing the work every day, being injured on the job, being chastised, being vilified, being assaulted while they were doing their job. And in fact, the police commissioner himself joined the people on the other side of the table against our people in those riots.
Now, when Ted Wheeler, the mayor of Portland, also the police commissioner, says we're going to get more people back on staff, and they talk about unarmed, non-sworn, non-police. But even when they talk about filling the gaps at the police bureau, are you going to be able to attract officers to an environment where they're going to look from a distance saying, do I want to take a job in Portland where they're going to blame me for going out and doing good police work when riots happen?
Well, a lot has to change. One thing has to change. They have to give us the right budget so that we can hire the amount of officers we need to hire. That will send a message that they're trying to support us somewhat. But not only that, they need to get rid of that false narrative, anti-police rhetoric, and support us and allow our leadership in the police bureau to do their job, and the subject matter experts that we have in the police bureau to do their job in policing the city of Portland as well as during these riots.
Do you see any sign that's happening?
We will find out. We have an October budget a session coming up, and we will find out if they're true to their word, if the mayor's true to his word, if some of the other commissioners are true to their word. They have a chance to make a change.
I mean, but having just blamed you for the crimes committed by others, do you see the likelihood that a majority of a city council of five is going to vote to give more money to hire more cops?
Right now, Portlanders are upset. Right now, Portlanders are unhappy with our elected officials. They're unhappy with the homicides, the murders, the crime, the violence. They're unhappy that they're able to go back downtown and open up their mom-and-pop businesses and be able to make a living, and they're losing their livelihoods. They're unhappy with all those things. If our elected officials cannot see that right now, then we are in deeper trouble than we thought we ever were.
All right, two recent incidents within the last few weeks. Seven shootings in a span of 15 hours, nine shootings in a span of 16 hours. This sounds like Portland's becoming Chicago.
The numbers are not the Chicago numbers, obviously, but this is not Portland. Hundreds of rounds are being fired in neighborhoods that put people at risk and in jeopardy. People who are innocent, people who want their kids to be able to play, live, and go to school in safe neighborhoods. That is not being done right now. Calls for service are mounting. Our dispatchers are being overwhelmed because they also suffer from catastrophic staffing issues, as well as the Portland Police Bureau. We have to do something to change. Our leadership has to become leaders, strong leaders. And right now, we don't have that.
Okay, so Daryl, call the blame on this one. Is the current stance of the police commissioner and the city council part of the reason that we're seeing seven shootings in 15 hours and nine shootings in 16 hours?
Lars, 2020, we were defunded $15 million in cash and another probably $10 million in positions. One of those special unit positions was the gun violence reduction team. That had a huge impact. You know, you saw the numbers. Everybody saw the numbers rising every month, catastrophic numbers rising every month of shootings, of homicides. They continue to rise every month. We are at record proportions right now. We cannot continue to have this happen. The people dying in the streets of Portland in broad daylight in many cases, as well as at night. So it is not safe for people to be out there day or night when these things are still going on. And we can't turn a blind eye. Our elected officials can't turn a blind eye to the fact that this is happening. And it is because of those cuts. It is because of those dissolving of those units. It is because of those things that these things are happening.
Absolutely right. That's Daryl Turner from the Police Association. Coming up, our vax order is going to destroy small town fire departments. And it's the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk radio. And of course, you're welcome to take part. You can send me an email, talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show. And the alternative is my website, LarsLarson.com, free from all the Jack Dorsey Twitter censorship. You can also call into the show, or emails like this one. I got one from Casey, who joins me now, Casey Watson, who's a volunteer firefighter. And he said, look, Lars, I found out last night volunteers are going to have to be mandated to take the vaccine in order to serve our community, which we do without being paid. Casey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So you sat down to write to me, and you said, look, this is going to do some terrible damage to a small community like ours. Would you mind sharing with my audience where that is?
That is in Clickitat County.
Okay. So you got a volunteer in fire Washington department. As I understand it, volunteer firefighters across America actually outnumber the professional firefighters. You're a bigger group of people.
I do believe that's right, yeah.
So here in the Northwest, we've got a lot of small towns. They depend on their volunteer fire departments. What have they told you about this vax mandate?
Well, this is something I just found out last night, late, that we were going to be mandated to get the vaccine, which, it's basically this has just all gotten out of hand. There's probably 15 of us on the fire department there. And when we get a call, which we only get a call maybe once a week, once every few weeks, we can go a month, which is nothing surprising. But when we do get called, usually 2 to 4 of us show up. But you get a call where 2 to 4 of us show up that aren't vaccinated, what do you do?
I guess you let the place burn. Most of them are medical calls, or most are fire calls in your community?
Most are, from a car injury to a car fire. Not really much safe for house fires, thank goodness. But if there was for a house to catch on fire, what's the difference between me not being vaccinated, being on the volunteer fire department, or being the neighbor going over and spraying the house with a hose until the fire department shows up? Because the next line of help, you're looking at 20 minutes to 30 minutes away.
And you're not in the professional fire service. There are people who end up going and effectively living at the fire station. The volunteers all live in their own homes, and they show up when the siren goes off, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So does that should that
goes off?
Should that change the vaccine mandate when you're not all living together, eating together, basically all living at the firehouse? Should the vaccine mandate be different for volunteers?
Oh, it shouldn't be any mandate whatsoever. I mean, we get called out, like I said, it could be once a month, and we train twice a month.
So for your volunteer fire department, Casey, how many of those 15 do you think or have already said, we're not doing it?
I really haven't got into that discussion with them. I mean, just being respectful of their privacy, You know, if they are, they are. If they're not, they're not.
You think the department is going to lose some of its volunteers?
If it does go through, possibly, yeah.
Okay. And what you made the point in the email you sent to me, this has implications beyond just the volunteer fire service. It has implications for the fire insurance for everyone who lives in your area. Tell me about that.
It's the insurance for the fire department itself.
Oh, and so if, the
you
liability?
Know, if you don't have a volunteer fire department, the liability part. If you don't have enough volunteers in the area, your homeowner's insurance could go up.
Okay, so that affects homeowners, but is there insurance as well on the volunteer fire department where the insurance company says unless you field a given number of firefighters, the fire department loses its insurance?
I do believe, as I said, I'll get more into this weekend when I talk more to the fire chief. You know, like I said, this is just new last night. We discussed it for 2-3 minutes, and then, you know, that was it.
Well, this sounds like an ugly situation. And Casey, I think the governors of both states have come to that conclusion. Governor Kate Brown has already backed down on her deadlines. Jay Inslee hasn't done that yet. King County has already backed down and said, well, we'll give you another, you know, 6 or 7 weeks to comply. I don't think it's going to change a lot of minds. I think the people who've already made a decision one way or the other are going to do what they want to do. Anything else you want to tell my audience?
That's it. You know, just get the word out, and I appreciate your time.
Okay, Casey, and thanks a lot for being a volunteer fire department. I do want to alert you to something that's going on outside the Northwest. In Collierville, Tennessee, I'm not that familiar with Tennessee, but police are responding to an active shooter at a Kroger grocery store. We're going to find out more about this as it goes on. You're likely to hear more about it on your top of the hour news on the Radio Northwest affiliate that you're listening to, because we're on throughout Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We try to provide honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. There is an email that I want to share with you that I had intended to get in earlier. Susan wrote in and she said, Lars, we've been watching what the Democrats are doing. Ever played the game of hearts? The idea is to collect the fewest number of hearts. Like golf, the lowest score wins. But there's a queen of spades. And she says, normally you try to dump the queen unless you think you can take all the important tricks by having enough high hearts like ace, king, queen, etc. It's called shooting the moon. If you make it, all the other players each get 26 points. I think this is what's going on. The Democrats are shooting for the moon. They've got nearly all the cards in place. I think they're going for it. Their chance to take control of us forever. This is what Susan is writing to me. The job for the rest of us players is to take at least one heart. Then the whole coup topples. Any idea which heart might be able to do it? I'm not sure I trust in the Supreme Court. Thanks for your insights. Signed, Susan Hayes. It's the Radio Northwest Network on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and it's a pleasure to be with you all over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We provide honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. If you don't like calling, you can always email talk@LarsLarson.com. So what happens when workers at a school are upset over vaccine mandates and one of them decides to protest against those vaccine mandates by making a comparison and showing up at the school in blackface? Lauren Pfefferle joins me now. Lauren's job is an education assistant. She is currently on administrative leave. Ms. Pfefferle, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure.
I'm glad that you made the choice to come on and tell this story, because I get frustrated when I hear somebody's been knocked out of their job, perhaps temporarily, because something's happened. But would you mind telling my audience why you decided to protest and what form that protest took?
Yes. So this happened exactly a week ago on Thursday, September 16th. And in the middle of my workday, I was on my way to lunch. A teacher approached me and communicated to me that basically there was a demand that I was not allowed to work with a particular student that I had been working with since the beginning of this school year. Wasn't allowed to work with this student anymore, and that I needed to be 6 feet apart from all students starting right away. And there was no thoughtful plan provided for the students or the staff as to how to go about this transition. It was just demanded on us right away. And these are, yeah, special education students. And so they have certain needs and certain goals, and that just adds extra layers to everything. And there was just some chaos there because we all weren't sure how to go about this moving forward. And so I went to lunch and then I came back and I was just kind of there and 6 feet apart and didn't really have a whole lot to do for the rest of that day. And so I went home and I thought, I feel segregated. I feel segregated because I am unvaccinated. Something is wrong here. And so the next day I went to work and I did put on some darker color on my skin part that showed. And I was going about my morning duties. And as there was opportunity to talk with the staff, I would say something, or sometimes other staff would say something to me like, oh, you look beautiful. And I would say, oh, I'm representing Rosa Parks today regarding segregation. By the way, which was Constitution Day. And so when I was briefly talking with a certain employee who was the school counselor, after just a brief talk, and she was very comfortable not letting me be fully heard, she marched over to the principal's office. And so I just continued my responsibilities, and in about 2 minutes later, I saw the principal, and he came up to me, and he did ask if everything's okay or how am I doing, and I said, I'm not doing okay. And so I briefly mentioned that I was representing Rosa Parks regarding segregation, and he said, you need to go talk to HR. So immediately, I had to go to HR, and while I was waiting for the HR director, there was also a union representative in the room, but I'm not technically a member with this union. So I'm waiting and I'm wondering, you know, who can be a witness with me through this meeting? So the union representative tells me, an attorney. Well, I don't have an attorney with me right now. So I started to call for one because I had a list on hand. And then the HR director came in and she just proceeded as if we were going to have a meeting. And I asked her, I said, are we having a meeting now? And she said, yes. And I didn't have an attorney with me. So I recorded the meeting and it was a brief meeting, but I basically mentioned how this is segregation. And so she decided to put me on administrative leave and said that I would get an email on Monday. So this was Friday, September 17th. And then Monday comes and I check my email. I see it. I see the letter. And then I also read that there's a press conference. And so I listened to the press conference and the superintendent was speaking. And in his response to this situation, it communicates to me two things. That he was told lies and doesn't have the whole story, or he was told lies and chooses to believe the lies and is spreading them to the community.
Okay, when you say lies, let me ask you something. This has been characterized as blackfacing. Were you blackfacing that day? Did you have on blackface makeup?
I did have darker skin makeup on my face and my hands, the parts of my body that were showing my skin. I never once thought of the word blackface because I honestly don't even know that term. I don't know what people mean by that. I don't use that language.
Well, because blackface is seen as it's insulting and it's ugly. It was actually a parody of black people way back in the day by vaudevillian, performers. And it wasn't at all complimentary. And there are a lot of politicians who've gotten into trouble and some others who've escaped trouble because of that. Do you have a moment to stay through the break? Because I know we're going to hit the break in about a minute. Tell me this before we go to that break, Lauren. I'm talking to Lauren Pefferle, who's an administrative assistant or on administrative leave. She's an education assistant in Newburgh Public Schools. She's been described as blackfacing, showing up at work in blackface. You just heard her say that's not what she did. She did say that she felt segregated like Rosa Parks, who's somebody who's so admired in this country that most cities have a street named after her. Do you think you've been put on administrative leave incorrectly?
I do.
Do you think there was anything you were doing that was damaging to kids?
I don't. I didn't intend to communicate verbally to the kids, especially since I'm in this particular special education environment where our kids don't have a whole lot of verbal communication.
Yep. Lauren, hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to continue this conversation with Lauren Pefferle in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails a bit later. They put her on her administrative leave. They say she was blackfacing. Of course, she didn't say that. We'll be back. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. And this is the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Northwest with honestly provocative talk. Lauren Pefferle has joined me. She is on administrative leave from her job in the Newburgh Schools as an education assistant. She was placed on administrative leave because, well, she was accused publicly by politicians, by the school district, of blackfacing. And you said you're not even familiar with that term and you don't know what it means and that was not your intent. Did you also say that you had put some of that makeup on your hands as well?
I did.
What was going on there? Ordinarily, makeup doesn't go on people's hands.
Right. That's just what I found to make my skin look a little darker. And so I just, my purpose was to put it on any parts of my body where my skin was showing. And those were the only parts that were showing.
Okay. But your intent was to say you felt like Rosa Parks. That's
correct.
What you said. Do you think there was anything wrong with that?
I don't.
I mean, at this point, do you regret having done it? Because you're now on administrative leave. It sounds like the rest of the school community in Newburgh, and I have my own disagreements with the school community in Newburgh, but they did something rather courageous a few weeks ago. They said, we want to get politics out of the classroom. And now they're using you and your example, your situation, as, you see, this is why we have to have politics in the classroom. I don't agree with them, but I wanted to ask you about that.
Correct. It seems as if they're twisting my story to fulfill their agenda.
Because you said you felt segregated by the requirement because you're not vaccinated, and they've said, well, then we're going to apply a different set of rules to you. You, as an unvax, you're treated differently than everybody else in the school who's vaccinated.
Correct. And I was actually, I guess, still in the process of, I had filed an exemption, and that hasn't been approved or disapproved, yet there were still these demands put on me and others all of a sudden.
Well, and you said they gave you no advance warning.
No advance warning. No,
okay.
This was not in the best interest of the student.
What kind of exemption did you file for? I have to ask.
Well, all the exemptions.
meaning what? Religious or medical? Because there are a couple of different ways to go about it.
Right. I did file a religious exemption.
And they've told you they won't tell you one way or the other?
Well, it just hasn't been decided yet, even though there's these demands being put on unvaccinated staff members.
Do you think you're going to get fired?
I do. I expect it. Yeah. And if not soon, then later, because as far as the process goes from what I've read and heard, if even my exemption is approved, it's like a dead end.
That's what I've heard from other workers, and I don't think it's a legitimate way for employers to act when they say, we're going to grant you a religious exemption to nurses, to doctors, to teachers, to firefighters, and the rest, and say, but by the way, having granted your exemption, under religious objections to taking the vaccine, you're not going to be scheduled for any work. You're not going to be on the payroll. We've effectively fired you, but we can't say out loud that we're firing you. So we're just telling you that you're not working, you're not getting a paycheck, but you're still on the rolls as an employee. I don't think that's legal. I think the school districts are going to run into a problem. If you end up getting fired, do you think your civil rights have been violated?
I do.
What do you plan to do about it?
Yeah, I have been trying to gather information on my options at this point because I am not very hopeful. And I am advocating that vaccinated and unvaccinated employees in the schools, as you said, in these other positions, that they be treated equally.
And you're not being treated equally. Anything else you want to tell people to help them understand what's going on?
Just along with that, what I'm attempting to advocate for is that we are all susceptible to getting COVID-19 and its variants. And so let us be thinking about these things.
Yeah, because, you know, that's been one of the craziest things about this, Lauren. All of last year, we talked about COVID, you know, sometimes more on some days, sometimes less. And everybody kept saying, well, we got to get the vaccine. When we get to the vaccine, it'll all be solved. And then what happened was we got to the vaccine and we've actually had bigger surges of COVID this year. And they say, oh, that's a different COVID. Well, what? Do you mean the vaccine doesn't work on that? And then they say, no, the vaccine doesn't mean you're not going to get it. It might mean that you're going to get a less severe case. It's not going to mean that you can't pass it on to somebody else. And it's led to some really bizarre conversations between me and listeners where it begins to sound like we're playing Abbott and Costello. That's going to date me. Who's on first? Let's see. Yeah. I have to get the vaccine. Why? Does that keep me from getting the disease? No. Does it keep me from giving the disease? No. Can a vaccinated person give the disease to another vaccinated person? Yes. Then what's the point? It won't
exactly.
be as bad. And you say, okay, it won't be as bad, but 20% of the people who died in the month of August in the state of Oregon in the hospital died of COVID-19 who were vaccinated. Is that what they mean by less severe? Because that seems pretty severe to me. It's a bizarre situation. How many other teachers in the Newburg schools have said, we're not going to do it. We're not going to get the vax. Do you know?
Yeah, I have heard in a board meeting, and I listened to that, and if the HR director was being honest, then it's at least 50 that haven't either responded to the exception, which we know is different than an exemption, and are still in this process.
I'm talking to Lauren Pfeffer. Lauren, I want to tell you honestly, because I just got an email that matches my reaction to your story when I first heard it, that I understand what you were trying to get across in comparing your situation to the segregation of Rosa Parks at the back of a city bus. But I also said to myself, I'm not sure that was the best way to get it across. Was this the best way to launch your protest against the mandate?
I, you know, didn't really know what to expect with it. I just felt a conviction inside of me to do it this way because we're not being heard, so we need to be seen.
In retrospect, was it a good idea to go about it this way?
I don't have any regrets.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. We'd love to know what happens as you contact a lawyer or do whatever you're going to do to try to insist on your own civil rights, because I think all of the employers, government and private, are going to end up with problems where they tell people, we won't respect your religious exception. We won't respect your ability to make decisions for yourself about medical matters. I think a lot of these employers are going to find themselves in court for a long, long time, years after we've learned how to handle COVID, however we learned how to do that.
Right.
All right, Lauren, good luck to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for hearing me.
You bet. That's Lauren Pfefferly. She showed up at school. She says she was not intending to appear as blackface, although she's been described that way by public officials and others. I kind of wonder if the lawyer might want to talk about that. Joe writes in, Lars, I consider myself a very conservative person, and this lady's story, like her makeup, was a bad cover-up. It makes me, as well as people of color, a reason to scratch our heads verbally and say, why do people do things like this and pretend they're not racist and do something that is very clearly racist? Well, if she's comparing herself saying Rosa Parks felt segregated at the back of the bus and Lauren Peverly felt segregated in that school classroom, are you not allowed to make that comparison? Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your calls shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, there is a mess on our southern border that actually began with the encouragement of a guy by the name of Joe Biden, who's now president of the United States. More than a year ago, he began encouraging people, saying if he became president, we would effectively have an open border on our southern border. We'd let anybody come in who wants to come in, and that's what we've got. The Biden administration dismantled almost everything that President Donald Trump had done to try to control our border. For example, about a year ago, there were maybe 50,000 people that came across illegally during the month of September. This year, it's 200,000 in a single month. And we've had month after month, there are now an estimated 1.3 or 1.4 million people who've entered this country illegally. And the Biden administration has no answer for this. And now lately, the newest development is Haitians coming in from all that far away. And we've literally got the Border Patrol being blamed by the White House for guarding the border, if you can believe that. Congressman Matt Rosendale joins me now, who's a Republican representing a district in the great state of Montana. Congressman, it's good to have you back.
Thank you for having me on today, Lars. I appreciate it.
So is there any real way that we're going to deal with this crisis with Joe Biden in office, assigning the problem to Kamala Harris, the vice president, and then she ignores it as much as he does?
Yeah, that's not going to resolve. But what we have to do is have the administration follow the rule of law. We literally have judicial decisions that have been issued that say that they have to slow down this flow of humanity coming through our southern border. They have said that the president and the administration has to start implementing the Remain in Mexico policy. We're starting to argue right now about the Title 42 policy so that we don't have these folks that very well could be infected with COVID streaming across our southern border. But this is a major problem. This is an invasion of our country, and anyone who tries to describe it of anything less is just not being honest with the American people. Like you said, there's over 200,000 people a month that have been streaming across the border. We've already seen 1.3 million illegals enter our country this year. Lars, that is larger than the entire population of Montana.
Yeah, that's right.
And just to put it in perspective.
But Congressman, that's a great perspective, because by the end of the year, the Border Patrol is saying we may have 2 million people coming into the country illegally. We have no idea where they are. They're probably going to go to sanctuary cities and sanctuary states. And this is damaging to the United States at a time when we don't need any more damage done. We've had COVID and everything else that's gone on that's creating real problems for families, rising energy prices, rising food prices. And yet I watched the White House today trying to dodge the question of, you've got 10,000 plus Haitians, maybe 12 or 15,000 Haitians, and they've come in, and you say you're sending them back to Haiti. How many have come in? How many have you released into the country? How many have you sent back to Haiti? And the White House says, we don't know. And I think they're trying to cover it up.
I think they don't know. I think we have an incompetent administration here. I started talking about this 10 months ago. Once we saw that Biden was going to be running this immigration issue, we knew that this is how it was going to devolve, and started screaming about it back then. I visited the border two times. I've witnessed it with my own eyes, and we've got a major problem. You're talking about having 2 million people by the end of this year, and guess what? By very definition of being an illegal immigrant, they're not allowed to work. They won't have any green cards. They won't have visas. And so there are going to be 2 million people here in our country that are going to need education, medication, housing, food. I sit on the Veterans Affairs Committee. We're not even accommodating and taking care of our veterans to the extent that we're taking care of these illegal immigrants. And it's very disturbing to me, and the 100,000 veterans and active military that are living in the state of Montana right now.
And in fact, by the way, one of your colleagues in the House of Representatives, Congressman Rosendale, Frederica Wilson, a Democrat from Florida, is now calling on the president to go to Haiti and Latin America and say, we'll give you money if you won't invade our country.
That's what I said. It literally is an invasion. We've got a discharge petition we're going to try to get presented and set on the House floor. But it's going to probably take about 7 days. Representative Andy Biggs from Arizona took the bill that I had put forward, the Remain in Mexico Act, which literally says that if you're going to claim asylum status when you come into the country, that instead of just being released into the United States, you're going to have to wait in Mexico, force the president to actually to implement the rule of law and make sure that we can at least begin to stem this flow of people coming into our country illegally.
And by the way, Congressman Rosendale, I know you've been on the issue of the Afghan refugees. Now, some of those people probably did help our service members while we were in a 20-year war over there. And some may have only helped a little bit, but we airlifted over 100,000 people into this country. And you pointed out the usual process for a refugee to come into the United States, in which you're given all the social welfare services for life that you could ever want. The usual process is over a year. And yet, in this case, the Biden administration said, to hell with the rules, we're just going to bring them in. And they're going to be shipped out to every corner.
They waved a magic wand, and they airlifted 120,000 Afghan refugees out. They were telling the American people that these folks were going to be thoroughly vetted before they brought them to the United States of America, and that is a flat-out lie. They granted them humanitarian parolee status. The very definition of that says that they could not have been vetted, okay? So we've got them on American soil as humanitarian parolees. They've got them on military bases. And, Lars, they're not even obligated to stay on those bases. They're staying there right now because they're being fed and housed, okay? But they are not obligated. The humanitarian parolee status says that they can leave that base anytime that they want to, and they have not been vetted, and we don't have the ability to vet these individuals now. We don't have the documentation. We don't have the eyewitnesses. As you said, this special immigrant visas that were being granted earlier in this year to the translators and folks that helped our military, that was a 14-step process that was taking 18 to 24 months. And these folks that had been brought in now, we've got even less information about them, and we're already starting to see that they're committing crimes on those military bases where they're housed, and we don't know if we have just released a terrorist into one of our communities.
By the way, Congressman, one of the crimes that they've been accused of committing is sexual crimes against children. So we know they've intercepted rapists. We know they've intercepted people that are on the terrorist watch list. And when you spoke of obligations, let me ask you about this. America has an obligation to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. We don't have the money to pay it. And all of these people, as you say, may never work for the rest of their lives. And they're all going to be an obligation of the United States that we are obliged to provide for them.
Exactly. And we don't even provide the services to our veterans that we have promised them when it comes to health care, mental health, proper mental health counseling across the nation. We are shortchanging them. We've got homeless veterans around our nation, and we're not taking care of them. But we've just brought 100,000 refugees in. We don't even know if they want to harm the people in this nation. There was one that they caught, and this has been documented. He was being ready to be airlifted from Germany to the United States. Thank goodness they looked in the suitcase. He had blasting caps and fuses in there. Now, look, I travel from Montana to Washington, D.C. regularly, and we're known for having the highest per capita gun ownership in the nation. But I want to tell you, I don't fly with blasting caps and fuses, Lars.
No, and nor do I. Congressman Matt Rosendale, who represents a congressional district in the great state of Montana, where I was once a resident a long time ago. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com. Go to NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. I'm going to get to this issue about Bill Gates and why he met with a convicted sex offender whose name has become very familiar. And no, I do not believe that Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. But let me get to that in a moment. I'm curious what Kat has to say about the Antifa riots. Kat, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yes, I wanted to let you know that I personally witnessed the group of Antifa on the Park Street in alcove at a church, bragging about making $1,200 a week to do the damage that they got on television for. This happened a few years ago before they showed the television riots. And when they got on TV, I started watching the television and noticed that, yes, they were being paid $1,200 a week.
That's what they claimed. Did they say who was paying them all this money, Kat?
No, it was no, but they were bragging about how much they were making. I thought it was unusual that they didn't give them hotel space. They had to sleep in the alcoves at the churches on Park Street.
Very interesting. A lot of us suspect that there's somebody behind Antifa, maybe not every member, but certain members who are the activists, the ones, the agitators, the ones who created all that. Antifa came up again today and BLM because the city of Portland, believe it or not, has said all those riots, the looting, the arson, the assaults on civilians, the murders that happened in both Portland and Seattle, that they are the fault of the police, not the criminals who actually did the acts, but the actions of police that brought it about. I think it's a load of hogwash, but there you go. Now, something very strange, because I've been following the case of Jeffrey Epstein literally for years now. This is a guy who's, let's start with the things we know for a fact. Jeffrey Epstein is dead. He died in jail under still unexplained circumstances. The authorities say, well, he took his own life while he was in one of the most maximum security jails they have. He had already been previously convicted of sexual offenses against underage girls. I don't buy the argument that he took his own life. I think he was murdered to keep him quiet because of all the dirt that he had on people like Bill Clinton. Remember Bill Clinton, president, impeached, flew on Epstein's plane, which I guess all you had to know was that the plane was known colloquially among those who rode on it and other people who knew about it as the Lolita Express. And where did that plane go? It went to a private island owned by Jeffrey Epstein known as Sex Island. Now, Judy Woodruff, who is an anchor at PBS, the taxpayer-funded left-wing news organization, but she still asked some very good questions just this week of Seattle billionaire Bill Gates, who was an associate of Jeffrey Epstein. And she asked some of the right questions. She wanted to know, why was somebody like Bill Gates, Microsoft billionaire, why was he associated with a guy who even at that time was already a convicted sex criminal who had committed sex crimes against underage girls? Take a listen.
When you met him 10 years ago, he was convicted of soliciting prostitution from minors. What did you know about him when you were meeting with him, as you've said yourself, in the hopes of raising money?
I had dinners with him. I regret doing that. He had relationships with people he said, would give to global health, which is a interest I have. Not nearly enough philanthropy goes in that direction.
Now, hold on a second. So Bill Gates acknowledges, when I met with Jeffrey Epstein, I knew he was a sex criminal. But that was okay because he promised to hook up some donors for global health care. And he says when the donors didn't materialize, he cut it off. But again, Woodruff went back with a follow-up question and said, why did you continue to meet with him?
It was reported that you continued to meet with him over several years. And that, in other words, a number of meetings. What did you do when you found out about his background?
Well, I've said I regretted having those dinners. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing new on that.
Is there a lesson for you, for anyone else looking at this?
Well, he's dead. So, in general, you always have to be careful. And, the You know, I'm very proud of what we've done in philanthropy, very proud of the work of the foundation. That's what I get up every day and focus on.
Now, hold on. I got to tell you something. My honest reaction to this is, do you think that Bill Gates has the capability? Do you think he has private security that makes sure that anytime he's going to go to somebody's house, go to their house for dinner, have a meeting with somebody, that his team can make sure they can vet the person that Bill Gates, billionaire, one of the richest people on planet Earth, that he knows exactly who he's meeting with and all the background about that individual? But he would have you believe, well, this guy said he could hook me up with some donors for global health. So we'll just ignore the fact that he's convicted of sexual crimes as though he didn't know anything about him. And Gates made clear in the interview he met with him until he found out the guy couldn't hook him up with any donors for the causes that he cares about. But to say, I'm willing to meet with these people, but forget about all that. Let's talk about charity. That's what he wanted to talk about, charity. Now, why did he keep on meeting with him? I don't know if we'll ever know. I'd love to have an interview with the guy. I would have to applaud Judy Woodruff, even though she's a bit of a liberal, for actually pursuing those questions with the great Bill Gates, billionaire of Seattle. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. I want to tell you something. I know that for many of you, you say the November 3rd election last year was as clean as the driven snow. It's clean as a houndstooth. There's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. Well, for a lot of us, we're going to wait to see what the Arizona audit shows when it's officially released on Friday, tomorrow. But in the meantime, many of us who live in the Pacific Northwest, in the states of Oregon and Washington, where vote by mail has been here for decades, and we've always been suspicious of it. And I think I've pointed out to people that if you are concerned about cheating on November 3rd in places like Arizona and Georgia and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, as I said, we haven't heard the last word on those elections yet. And much of the cheating revolved around mail ballots. And if you said, but we live in Oregon or Washington, we've had mail ballots forever, and there's no sign of cheating anywhere in sight. I've pointed out to you that the way that mail balloting is structured, if there's any cheating, you're probably never going to see it. And it's going to be exceptionally hard to find it because it can all be done behind the scenes. If somebody sends in a fake ballot purporting to be one person when they are in fact somebody else, or they send in 10 ballots, it's going to be almost impossible to detect the fraud, to prove the fraud, and to eliminate the fraud. So I'm glad to see that there are some efforts out there to try to get to the bottom of what's going on in Northwest elections, in this case, in Washington State. Robert Sutherland joins me now, representing Washington's 39th District. Robert, good to have you back on the program.
And Mr. Larson, it's a privilege being here. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. Tell me about the lawsuit that has been filed in several Western Washington counties saying auditors are using uncertified voting equipment and that they're manipulating thousands of ballots in a statewide race that happened last year, an unspecified race. It didn't happen in November, did it?
I am not the one writing the lawsuits, and there are various lawsuits, one in Snohomish, one in Clark, Whatcom, Pierce, Thurston, King. And I've not read all the complaints myself. I'm working with groups that are active in this arena. But I do know for what I believe is a fact that some of these election machines were not certified during the 2020 elections. There's evidence to show that votes are being flipped. And let me just say this based on your opening statement. I can say, my past life, I'm a biochemist. I did cancer drug development. I'm used to data. And I can say with 100% certainty, 100% certainty, we have election irregularities, cheating, whatever you want to call it, here in Washington State, without a doubt. The only question that arises is, well, to what level is that cheating going on? And that's the critical key. We're out there knocking on doors. We're getting stories and signed affidavits from people that are in their houses saying, I did not vote in November of 2020. And yet when I go online, there it is, my vote is cast. Or they went in to drop off their ballot and they're rejected because they're told that you've already voted. you already mailed in your ballot. And they're like, no, I didn't. We have over 1,000 signed affidavits of stories like that. It's happening. It's real. We're just trying to get to the bottom of it, of how significant it is. And that is why these lawsuits are being dropped, so we can take a look at the actual ballots and line them up with actual voter registration rolls. And only then can we determine the level and the scope of the cheating that is occurring in Washington state.
By the way, I appreciated your making the point that you've got to know, well, to what extent is it happening? But if somebody is cheating in elections and they're only cheating to achieve a result that would have come out of the election anyway, that one really doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, if you said, well, we've created a whole bunch of fake ballots in the last election. And if somebody, if they were speaking honestly and you said, well, did you create enough to change the result? Oh, no, we just were cheating just because you can cheat. There's no point to cheating unless you cheat to win, is there?
I can't answer as to why people cheat or their motivation, but let me answer that this way. In Skagit County, they have over 1,000 signed affidavits showing various levels of cheating or again, people voting in other people's names and things like that. The Delta, that's beyond the Delta of what some of the races were decided by. One race.
By the way, he's using scientific terms. I like scientist terminology, but a delta means a difference, a change, right? Like a delta in right. Velocity.
There are races in this state. I mean, one only needs to look back at the gubernatorial race in 2004 with Dino Rossi. I think he lost by 100 and something votes, right?
Yep. Well, hold on. He won the first count. Hold on, Robert. You know, as a scientist, you should appreciate this. If you do research and you say, I want a certain result, and you go back and you add up the numbers and you don't get the result you want. So you say, let's go back and add up the numbers again. And we'll keep adding up the numbers till we get the result we want. I think that's the technique the Democrats used to install Christine Gregoire as governor of the state, don't you?
I believe you are 100% correct. We have past evidence of this voter cheating, if you will. We have evidence, these aren't hunches, these aren't gut feelings. We have evidence that the amount of this cheating going on is greater than the differences in those races. Now, that doesn't prove anything until it just shows that we have evidence of cheating going on at a greater extent than what would be necessary to change a certain result in a race.
Now, let me ask you this.
We won't know until we can do an audit.
I agree. Is this lawsuit or likely, you know, what you're asking for from the courts? Usually when you go to court, the lawyers talk about a remedy. What's the remedy? And is the remedy you're looking for a full forensic audit so we know whether there's cheating going on in Washington's vote by mail?
A full forensic audit would be necessary. Because as you touched on, you can do a hand recount, and you're going to get the same count as the machine most likely. But the problem is the votes coming in, the ballots coming in, are not the true ballots in many cases. We don't know the number of that until we actually look at the ballots. So the lawsuits are in my understanding, are for the purpose of being able to take a look at these ballots, do an audit. You can't just have the auditor do an audit. They just count the ballots versus the machine count, and they say, we recounted and everything's cool.
Yep.
They're not looking at the signatures. They're not looking at the ballots themselves, whether or not they're legal ballots or whether they're printed off of someone's computer. They're not looking at anything that would demonstrate the level of cheating and fraud that we have evidence of.
And you go to court. How soon do you think you might get a decision from a judge?
Oh, one thing I will say, I am not an attorney. I don't know how the wheels of justice turn in this state. Sometimes they come very quickly, and sometimes they just seem to take forever. So I don't know the answer to that question. We're hoping we can get positive results, as soon as we can.
Absolutely. That's Representative Robert Sutherland. He's a Republican from Granite Falls. He represents the 39th Congressional Legislative District. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about Jen Psaki and illegals on the border.
Why should somebody, say, in Laredo, Texas, or El Paso, or Tucson, Arizona, have to have their chance of catching COVID go up because hundreds of miles away there is an open border?
Well, there certainly is not an open border. We are continuing to employ our immigration proceedings and process and restrictions at the border.
That is Jen Psaki, and she speaks for the President of the United States. Usually Jen Psaki's job every day is to try to sort out what Joe Biden said the day before. That was until the White House decided to simply cut him off. I mean, because you've noticed that in the last few weeks, anytime Joe Biden tries to answer an extemporaneous question from somebody, you know, one that wasn't planned and set up in advance, the White House simply cuts the feed. The other day, the president was actually meeting in the Oval Office with another world leader. And as Boris Johnson began taking questions from the reporters who were there for the photo op and answering the questions, that's what politicians do and that's what reporters do. When Joe Biden started to answer a question, his White House staff literally shouted loudly enough that the president's answer could not be heard. Now, imagine this, where the White House staff is scared to death that Joe Biden might actually answer a question on his own. But here's why. Because you've got people like Jen Psaki with a straight face who can stand up. The guy who was asking the questions was Peter Doocy from Fox News and say, well, you know, we don't have an open border. Really? We have 6,000 illegals a day coming across our southern border. We have had 10 or 12,000 Haitians who made their way all the way from Haiti to Mexico and then across the border illegally. And now they're trying to fly some of them home, although the number that are actually going home versus the number that are being released into the United States to make their way to sanctuary cities, I think the Biden administration is trying to hide the ball on this one. But she literally stood there and said, there's no open border. I mean, she's acting again like Baghdad Bob. There are no American troops in Iraq during the time when there were very certainly American troops in Iraq. But Doocy pressed hard on this because what they're doing is they're saying, well, we have 15,000 or so Haitians. We're going to fly them home. They've flown a few hundred of them home. Some of the Haitian refugees have objected to this. One group of them took over a bus from ICE and managed to escape. Others have bitten flight crew. They've bitten ICE agents on the flights home. They've tried to mob the planes when they land in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and say, no, no, you have to fly us back to the United States. They've literally attacked the pilots of those planes. This is another chaotic debacle engineered by the Biden administration. So then Jen Psaki gets asked about, what are you going to do? Are you going to deport these people? Take a listen to her answer.
But it's not just him. We've heard from Democrats on Capitol Hill, too, who say they're really against these mass deportations. The White House still stands behind the mass deportations. You still view them as humane?
First of all, they're not deportations. People are not coming into the country through legal methods. And again, our policy process has continued to be the same with Haiti as it is for anybody coming through irregular migration across our border.
Now, hold on a second. She says, we're sending people who've entered the United States illegally back to their home country. But according to Jen Psaki, who speaks for Joe Biden, this is not at all a deportation. This is simply removing somebody from one country and sending them to another country, which for those of us who know the English language reasonably well, that sure looks like a deportation to me. The other crazy thing is that even though we are seeing a massive problem on our border, 200,000 people in the month of August, 200,000 plus in the month of July, 200,000 plus in the month of June, very nearly 200,000 in the month of May, that despite that, she says, no, no, we don't have a problem. And in fact, it's actually that bad Trump fellow, you know, the bad orange man. He actually created this problem. Listen to what Jen Psaki says about Donald Trump.
Explain clearly what our policy is and what our policy is not. We could not see it as any more different from the policy of the prior administration, which the president feels, we all feel, was inhumane, immoral, ineffective, wasn't operationally working. And because of the dysfunction of it, we have led to a very broken system that we're dealing with today.
Hold on. Donald Trump created the problem. Last year, the border was under control as it's been in a couple of decades. This year, it's absolutely out of control. And it was inhumane.
Has Jen Psaki forgotten who made the cages for the kids? Why, that was the Obama-Biden administration back when Joe was vice president and his son was making bank by selling influence to foreign countries. They're the ones who created the cages for kids, which then under Donald Trump, Trump said, look, we're going to get this under control. We're going to make it clear you cannot come into our country illegally. And the number of kids and parents and unaccompanied minors went down dramatically. But then again, you've got Jen Psaki, and she talks about the missteps. Take a listen to her answer to this question.
What do you say to a voter who might be saying, I thought Biden was going to know how to run this government, but now we're looking at a potential government shutdown in a week and a default on U.S. debt?
I would say that every president is elected to weather storms and navigate crises, and they come to every presidency. I would say on other issues, we are doing everything we can to prevent a government shutdown and planning to prevent the impact that we've seen in the past that has been quite devastating on different components of government. We're right now in the midst of trying to get a historic package that's going to address a lot of issues the American people care about across the finish line, and making policy is messy. So we're right in the middle of that.
Yeah, we're right in the middle of that. No, they're right in the middle of multiple crises that are of their own creation. Folks, I don't think there's a clear way to say this. The reporter didn't list them all off, but think about where we are. We have unemployment out of control because we have 10 million open jobs. We have millions of people still on unemployment. And all the White House can say is shovel out some more free money so we can keep those people from actually going to work for one of the many, many employers out there who are begging for workers to come work for them. And the administration has sabotaged that. That's one crisis. You've got the border, which is a second crisis. You've got the exit from Afghanistan. I agree with America exiting Afghanistan, but not the way they did it. And I know what they're saying is, well, you're saying you're against leaving Afghanistan. No, I'm not. But there are lots of things I'm in favor of. If my stepson, Brandon, came to me and said, I'm thinking of getting a new car, I might say, that's a great idea. I hope you do get a new car. That it's always nice to get a new car. If he went out and stole the car and showed up and said, hey, look at my new cars. How'd you get that? I stole it. Well, Brandon wouldn't steal a car. I'm just using it as an odd example. You'd say, you shouldn't steal a car. If he said, well, didn't you say you were in favor of me getting a new car? I said, yes, but not that way. This is what Americans are saying to President Joe Biden. We're not in favor of shoveling out free money for people not to work. We're not in favor of hundreds of thousands of people crossing the border illegally and creating a massive health and humanitarian crisis on our border. We're not in favor of most of the ways that this White House has chosen to mismanage everything it can mismanage. Take a listen to Ducey again trying to get Jen Psaki to say, is the border open or not?
You say the border is not open, but we're told by our teams on the ground, you guys are releasing pretty much all family units, couples where the woman says that she is pregnant, or single women who say that they are pregnant, and that nobody actually has to take a pregnancy test unless they want to. So,
are you suggesting you don't believe when women say they're pregnant? Is that a big issue?
That's
you think
what
at the
Jen
border?
Psaki does. She tries to change the subject. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. The Biden White House has managed to create yet another major crisis for itself. It's hard to actually keep track of them. You almost need a scorecard, like watching a big sports league go down in brackets. Which one are they on now? Is it the inability to fund the federal government? Is it the inability to manage the COVID pandemic? Is it the mandates that are coming down telling Americans what they must do? No, this time it's the 200,000 people they've allowed to come across the border, mostly into Texas, every single month for the last several months. And now more than 10,000 Haitians who somehow managed to find their way to the Mexico border. I thought I'd ask the perfect man to ask about this is Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Attorney General Paxton, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me back. We can talk about a crisis every day, and I could say it's all on purpose.
Yeah, it does seem to be all on purpose, although according to the White House and Jen Psaki, it's all Donald Trump's fault. Do you buy that?
No, I mean, look, I think the people behind Biden are kind of letting him take the fall. It's his approval numbers that are going down. I'm not sure if he's even aware of that. And unlike most presidents who want to run for re-election, my guess is they have no plans for him to run for re-election, and they're okay with him having plummeting numbers and creating all the crises that they can possibly come up with.
It kind of reminds me of hockey, where they have one guy who's the enforcer. Maybe that's not the term. And when they want to take out one of the other team members, they say, go out and knock that guy into the boards and put him off the ice. And you say, but I'm going to end up sitting in the penalty box. That's okay. That's what you're here for. Go out and knock that guy out. And then you sit him in the penalty box for a while, right?
Honestly, no one would. We've never had a president in this position where he probably can't run a second term anyway. And so they're just putting him up there to take all the hits and do as much damage as he can to the country. And then, you know, they'll just say he's no longer going to run for whatever reason, whatever it is, mental health or whatever. And he'll be replaced by their next person up. But it won't be that person who had done all the damage.
General Paxton, let me, before I forget to do it, because I don't want to be remiss, I want to thank the people of Texas, because your legislature just said we're going to put $2 billion into border security. So, in effect, saying if the federal government won't do it, we'll do it with the money from the people of Texas. I think that's above and beyond what we'd expect of most states, to take on a federal problem with the money from one state that, you know, I know you're a very productive state. You got the second biggest economy in America, but still in all, $2 billion to put into border security because Joe Biden won't do the job?
Well, there's no doubt there's a lot we could do with that money, build roads, provide, you know, education to students, health care. There's all kinds of things we could do with that money. We could give a tax cut. But the reality is we know there's a lot of damage being created. We know the federal government is refusing to follow their constitutional duty to implement federal law. And so we're trying to do our best to make up the difference, even though $2 billion really in the long run won't fix the entire problem. The federal government should be funding this, and they clearly are not going to do that.
Okay, General Paxton, the focus has been on the 10 or 15,000 Haitians that are currently camped out, a few hundred of them flown back to Haiti, but camped out under this freeway bridge. And the White House has been saying, we don't have the numbers. We don't know how many we're deporting, or Jen Psaki didn't like the term deporting, sending back to their home country, whatever you call that, if you don't call it deporting. But the question has been, where are the rest of them going? And the suspicion is they're simply being cut loose at the orders of the White House. Is that what's happening? Are they being cut loose in your state?
I have no doubt that that's exactly what's happening. They may be moving them to other states, letting them cross the border in Texas, or they may be moving them. And I do not put anything past this administration. They have clearly opened the border. They clearly have invited these people. This is not a crisis. This was planned from day one for this to happen. And their goal is to get as many people across that borderline as fast as possible before somebody in the federal court says, hey, we're going to hold you accountable. We're going to start making you suffer some type of consequence if you don't follow federal law. And that's what they're trying to do. They're ignoring it, and they're going to keep crossing as many people as they can.
I'm talking to Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. So the question is, how do we get this to stop? I mean, the American public, the people I talk to, the people I get emails from are like, what do we do about this? We've got a president who's out of control, a border that's out of control, crises in every direction. How do we get this to stop? Is there any mechanism? You're an attorney general. You're a lawyer. You've got ideas. What's the way to stop this?
Well, I would say stay tuned, because I think you're going to see some action by us relatively quickly to hold the Biden administration accountable for not following federal law, for not following what the Supreme Court told them to do, which was to re-implement the Stay in Mexico program, which was required by federal law. You're going to see some action by us to try to hold them accountable and to find out exactly what's going on.
Well, I did like the idea that the Texas Department of Public Safety, when the Biden administration shut down the overflights because they wanted people not to be able to see what was going on down there, DPST said, hey, hop in our helicopter. We'll give you a ride. And we got lots of pictures. And then they came up with the idea of, let's park a whole bunch of vehicles and make a steel wall down there. Are you planning to just put the entire state motor pool on the border to try and keep people out?
I wish we had enough vehicles to do that. It's 1,266 miles, if I remember that correctly. And that's
a lot of cars and trucks.
That many vehicles. Yeah.
So now the bigger problem is, people may say, well, that's 10 or 15,000 people, pales by comparison to the 200,000 monthly we've been seeing coming in from Mexico. You know, or you, as I understand it, Texas has been put on notice. 10,000 won't be the end of it. It's just the beginning, and the numbers get much bigger very fast.
Oh, yeah. It's those are just the numbers we know about. I mean, who knows what the real truth is? These numbers are numbers we have never seen before. And the fact that we have more drug-related issues with fentanyl and how deadly that is, and the fact that we have COVID, which can kill people, tied into the normal problem of immigration, the Biden administration, despite those two major factors, and not to count just normal human trafficking, normal crime associated with it, and they continue to say we want more and more and more and more of this. They don't care about the American people at all. If they're going to let people die from fentanyl, they're going to let people die from COVID, because it's not going to just stay in Texas. It will spread everywhere, and we will lose people, and the Biden administration is willing to trade those lives, for more people voting in these states.
So what should Americans think when they're told you have to get vaccinated, you have to wear a mask, you have to distance, you may have to lose your job, but then we're told that hundreds of thousands of people, unvetted, unvaccinated, many of them with COVID, are being allowed to flood across. What should Americans think of that?
They should think that somebody's lying, because the reality is you can't have the policy telling Americans, lecturing them about vaccines that they have to, and trying to, tell them to go lose their job. They have to wear a mask, or they can't fly anywhere. They can't go here. They can't go there. And then you say, please come across our border. We don't care if you've got COVID. We will transport you all over the United States with COVID. Those two things don't match up. That tells me they don't really care about COVID. They're doing the COVID mandates for other reasons. I don't know what they are, but they aren't what they say.
Okay, one last hard question for Attorney General Ken Paxton from Texas. Why did Texas back down on the horse patrols? Because I've talked to cops over the years. Horse patrols are great for crowd control. Why back down on that and say, okay, we're going to discontinue the use of horse patrols?
I'm not sure it was Texas that backed down. I think that was Border Patrol. That was the feds ordering their guys not to do that. I mean, the feds have been ordering their guys not to do anything. And that's why, the head of the Border Patrol left. He was forced out because they never once asked him to do anything about stopping this illegal immigration. What they did was they criticized him. Every time he tried to do the right thing, he got criticized. He finally just got pushed out.
Tom Homan? Was that Tom Homan?
Oh, this was Rodney Scott. The chief of the Border Patrol. But they those guys were all in the Trump administration. This guy was pushed out during the Biden administration.
Jeez. And this is just insanity and lunacy. Attorney General Ken Paxton from the great state of Texas. General Paxton, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. To your calls and emails next at 866-439-5277. And on the Lars Larson Show, naysayers always go to the head of the line. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I kind of get a kick out of getting emails from people who say, hey, Lars, have you heard they're setting up internment camps in Washington State? Well, they're not exactly internment camps. But yesterday, we actually talked to a county commissioner from Klickitat County. And yep, sure enough, Jay Inslee has arranged for the state to set up isolation and quarantine centers, one in Centralia. The other one, I believe, is in Ellensburg or another part of Central Washington. And we asked the county commissioner, I said, what do you know about this? He says they dropped it on us, his words, in the dead of night, and then later apologized for not telling us about it ahead of time. And I said, well, who are they locking up in these isolation centers? He said, we really don't know. They appear to be foreign nationals. They appear to have come from places like SeaTac Airport, and they're being brought to places like Centralia, which is an hour and a half's drive from SeaTac Airport. And then people are being held there with COVID. I said, are they held against their will? He said, I don't know. We can't tell. We don't know anything. All he knows is the local hotelier has leased out his entire facility. I think it's 40 or 50 rooms for $125,000 a month. And the state of Washington is doing this. And he says state residents are not allowed to quarantine there, but foreign nationals are. And I said, are these Afghans? Are they illegal aliens? Do you have any idea? And the answer was, no, we don't know. So that's what we get. Even from those in public office who you'd expect would know about it, they're not being told much by the Inslee administration either. So the more information we can shake loose on that, as far as I'm concerned, the better. To your calls now. And glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. I should tell you that this hour of the show is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the ultimate hot tub and swim spa experience. Just visit online at MarqueeHotTubs.com or go to one of their three physical locations. To your calls now. Let's go first to Tim Hey, Tim, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. How you doing? Well, I just want to bring up, I'm a retired Marine Corps major, and with our new commander, with our commander-in-chief here, talking dishonorable discharges for vaccine troops and people that turn it down, well, that equates to a felony conviction. And I'm not sure if people appreciate what that means. I mean, anybody that goes through that because they turn down the jab, they will potentially face losing their voting rights, their rights to bear arms, parental rights, potentially social services, depending on state rules, and on, along with VA benefits, et cetera. I don't think it affects medical, but that's a pretty serious offense. And they have to report that they're a felon, convicted felon, for their job applications for the rest of their life or whatever the state rules are where they're at. And that's a pretty heavy penalty to apply for the circumstances, I think.
A dishonor, and it makes no sense to say we've added a new condition of employment. Would you like to meet that condition? If somebody says, no, I choose not to, and they then say, whatever you did, all your service in uniform is wiped out by a dishonorable discharge, and you'll go through the rest of your life with that hanging over you, and it's going to constrain you in a whole, you know better than I do, Major, what that's going to do to people. And the fact that the Biden administration has this little regard for the military, do you know, we got numbers the other day that as much as a quarter of the SEALs, I mean, the elite of the elite, the SEALs, a quarter of them are saying, we're not taking the vax. We're going to take a quarter of all the SEALs who are about, some of them are about to be deployed, and they're being told, take the vax or we will not deploy you. And they're saying, nope, not going to do it. And you're going to wipe out a quarter of the SEALs for the United States Navy? That's crazy.
Well, worse than that, you're going to hang them with the felony conviction. There are processes in place, and I'm sure people have been kicked out for refusing medical because readiness is certainly important, and I've even been on the receiving end of that. But to elevate it to the point of a dishonorable discharge, a felony conviction, that's something that no matter where you are, that should raise some alarms and be disconcerting. As you mentioned, SEALs and specials, but you even got your troops on the ground. You know, we've got issues with pulling out Afghanistan and mental health that people are going to be wrapped up about that as well, and then potentially get kicked out with a no-trash felony conviction for the time and commitment they've put to the country.
No, and in fact, Tim, I've been getting emails from people who've been saying, look, my husband or my wife has 19 years in. They'd like to get to their 20, and they're now being pushed out the door. And Tim, a lot of us, I believe this, believe that what they're doing is they're using the vaccine and the willingness to say yes to a government mandate as a way to push out people of a certain point of view, not just politics, but, you know, that they're trying to take the most capable people, the people who believe in American liberties and freedoms, and saying, we don't want you in our military. That in a lot of ways, this is an ideological test for people in the military.
Well, it is Conspiracy Thursday, so that would fit.
Yeah, it sure would. Hey, Major, thanks very much. I appreciate your service to America in uniform. Let me go to Scott. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Northwest Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. How are you?
Doing quite well, sir. Thank you.
All right. Hey, I just wanted to full circle with you. Last week, you talked about the situation that was going on with the firefighters down in Corvallis.
Yep.
And so we had an opportunity. I'm a professional firefighter in the state, and we had a bunch of firefighters that were able to go down, and lots of other people. And we went down today to show support for those firefighters, and just demonstrate very peacefully that's not acceptable. That how they're being treated is not reasonable accommodations. It's punishment.
It really is. And Scott, imagine this. If you're a professional firefighter, part of your week you spend living at the firehouse. You live there, you sleep there, you eat there, you're with your whole crew. And these rules that Corvallis rolled out say you will wear a mask 24 hours a day, even when you're sleeping. You will not eat with your crew. You know, all these other restrictions. It's absolute lunacy. Thank you, Scott.